Welcome to this Tuesday's Main Street on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, in Plainsfolk, Dr. Tom Easern shares The Hungry Bachelor, a frontier ballad shaped by life on the prairie. And in Our Living Lands, the Chickasaw Nation plants trees to protect both climate and culture for the next generation. Main Street begins today with former U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, who joins a conversation on healthcare with co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner to discuss a new bipartisan effort to confront what she calls a moral failing in rural healthcare, why Americans in rural communities are living sicker, dying younger, and what can be done to change that trajectory.
Well, Secretary Sebelius, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, this is such an optimistic report in that it says America needs rural America to be healthy and positive because it can be done. But also the report calls the rural mortality gap a moral failing, which sounds like it's frank and strong language. Why did you feel it was important to frame it that way?
Well, let me start kind of at the beginning. The Aspen Health Strategy Group has been focusing on one topic a year for a decade. And the idea is bringing together a large bipartisan group involving experts who have studied these issues for a long time and trying to identify key healthcare issues across the spectrum. So rural health was a topic that we chose for the report for 2025, in large part because it affects so many people. And I think there's so much misunderstood about rural America and the definition of rural America. So we really felt it was important to do a deep dive. The more we got into the facts and statistics, the more kind of outrageous it became, because there are failings at every point along the way, failings from government, failings from states looking at economic development. But 50 million Americans live in areas that are defined as rural, and it's a much less heterogeneous group than one would think. It is old and young people in every state in the country. So we thought it was time to kind of sound the alarm, but the, if you will, the death mortality of living in rural America, meaning that you're going to live sicker and die younger than if you lived in urban America, I think can be reversed. The trend has really only started in the last 40 years. And while that sounds like a lot, there are steps that can be taken quickly and aggressively to begin to reverse that trajectory.
Well, that is a good, powerful statement to make right up front. We're going to pick up on some elements of that. But in more recent times, we, of course, had COVID. And the report states that COVID was so devastating for rural America that it wiped out 30 years of improvements in mortality among men, which is a pretty shocking figure. That happened in many other places in the country as well. But we note, or you note in the report, that there's been historically a lower uptake of preventive services in particular, not just something like a COVID vaccine, but all preventive services. Do you think that the rural transformation bill is going to significantly change that? There's a lot of factors that contribute to why people don't use preventive services. How will it make a difference, do you think?
Well, I think, unfortunately, two things were done simultaneously. So the rural transformation bill was actually an investment of $50 billion into rural health communities. The bad news is that the global bill, the big, beautiful, so-called big, beautiful bill passed by Congress, took $147 billion out of Medicaid. And Medicaid spending in rural communities is incredibly important. It is the lifeline of a lot of hospitals. It helps to support individuals' health care. So first, the math doesn't add up. Three times as much was lost as was invested. And the second unfortunate feature of the bill, and I think members of Congress are currently debating and working on trying to change it, is that nothing in the new resources can be used for infrastructure. So if a hospital is about to close its doors, while the Transformation Act may provide money for some new project, some you know, high tech, use of AI, it's not going to keep the hospital doors open because you can't use it for operating expenses. And every rural health expert we heard from, particularly people running small hospitals in very isolated areas, small clinics in isolated areas, said the real issue is keeping the doors open, paying for the infrastructure that they have, paying for staff, and none of that is eligible for money under the new federal bill. So there's a real disconnect. The math doesn't add up, and the dollars needed are not necessarily being directed in the right place.
Margaret, we've heard
that. Other than that, it's a great idea.
How was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? We've heard from a number of people that we've had on the show really talk about that disparity between what was cut and what is out there. $50 billion sounds like a lot, but it really is comes up short. And in part because there wasn't an ability to have a bipartisan solution in Congress. But you have a bipartisan committee. You co-chair the initiative with former U.S. Senator Bill Frist, who is a Republican. So I guess I want to ask about the section of the report that states the cuts to Medicaid, as you indicated, included the administration's one big, beautiful bill, are alarming and threatening to the stability of rural hospitals, as you just said, and other rural providers. Did you find it difficult to come to conclusion with this politically diverse group on that topic?
Not at all. In fact, what was really interesting is the bill was being debated and passed during the course of our meeting together. So we were physically in a room. We were not intending to actually comment on what Congress was doing, but the timing was such that it's like we're here talking about this topic and Congress is debating a bill which could be increasingly devastating to rural health care. So we, the proposal, the language that Bill and I co-authored a letter to key committee chairman and then included a portion of the statement in the report, and he actually authored the language. It was probably tougher than I would have proposed just because I was trying to be sensitive to the fact that, you know, we had people on the Republican side who might not be as comfortable with really tough language, but former majority leader, Senator Frist, my co-chair, was the one who said, absolutely not. We need to make this very clear that this is, you know, this is a big step backward. It is a big step in the wrong direction. So, you know, one of the things that we talked about a lot in the report, and so it was ironic that this debate was going on, was the federal policies in place, payments for Medicare, incentives for new ways that health providers come together, a whole series of things are really not aimed at rural communities. Often the formulas don't work in rural communities. The population numbers are too high. You can't qualify. If you're a doctor with a small rural clinic, you don't qualify as an accountable care organization. So there's a lot of mismatch already in federal policies. And while the Congress has often taken steps to then correct it, they're looking in the rearview mirror. So a bill is passed and 5 or 10 years later, they pass a correction and then a second bill is passed, but it's never forward thinking. We were hoping, not successfully, that maybe some of these comments would actually change some of the formation of the transformation grant or the bill itself. That did not happen. But I think Congress is paying more attention, and if they act, they may act more quickly to look at solutions. In the meantime, I think we're hoping a lot of the recommendations can be implemented and advocated and put together at the state level. Mm-hmm. And that can go on regardless of what the debate is in Washington.
Well, it certainly sounds like from reading the bill, and we've tried to stay current on both what was written in the bill and also what the states are now sending out. There's an effort to try and hold true to it being the states that decide what the priority is, to try and do things which have durability, right, that change things enough that you're on a new pathway or a new glide path going forward. And certainly a big focus on access, although, as you say, if the doors of the hospital close, that's a real problem in terms of access, mm-hmm. perhaps investments in other areas, workforce recruitment of people to states that, you know, perhaps have seen all the training efforts happening at the urban big academic medical centers and obviously technology and so forth. Are there any elements of those five or six big core areas that you think do have promise to make a substantive difference going forward? I know you skew to the optimistic side of the house, despite all of your many years of experience.
I'm a Democrat in Kansas. I have to be optimistic.
That's right. Where do you see some hope, or have you seen some states that you think can grab this and run with it in a positive way?
Well, I do think, again, hopefully there'll be features of the bill that will focus more on, one of the issues is getting the money to rural areas, even within a state. That's not guaranteed. The way the bill is designed, it is not, it's like every state gets a little bit of money and every state gets to do some things that are cool and inventive. That may not match at all the gaps in the rural area in that state. And that's why it's so important for states to be able to weigh in around a definition of rural and say, here are the three or four things that need to go on in Kansas or in California. Every state has a rural area, but they all don't need the same things. They all don't have the same gaps. There's distance requirements or transportation needs. You know, if you think about the so-called social drivers of health and transportation, food issues, air and water quality, the impact of social drivers in rural areas is sometimes heightened because people live farther distances away. So you may have a doctor, but if you're living 50 miles away and you don't have a car, that's not access. You may have a clinic and the clinic is connected again to a hospital, but if you can't get a provider to work in the clinic, that's not access. So there are gaps in services that are desperately needed to be filled. I think some of the workforce issues are critical. Mm-hmm. And a lot of states, including a state like Kansas, has the kind of give back program where medical debt is forgiven if you, medical school debt is forgiven if you will practice in a rural area and scholarships for rural areas and internships in rural areas. And what we found through just the Kansas program is that a lot of people would love to go back to their hometowns, would feel very mission oriented by being able to practice there if there is an opportunity to make a living and, some way to pay off it. If they're coming out of school with a couple hundred thousand dollars in medical school debt, going to work in a rural area is probably not a great way to try to pay that off. So those programs really can have a dramatic impact. There's a similar program at the federal level that can be beefed up and I think help open a pipeline of workers. Keeping the doors open in hospitals is both about access, but also hospitals in rural areas tend to be the largest employer in the area. They tend to be a social center in the area. So one of the ideas in the report, which I think, again, can be done at the state and local level, is having rural economic development start with healthcare. Looking at that as the access issue rather than building a factory or doing something else, make it about healthcare because the reality is people will not live in a community if they don't have easy access to healthcare. And so if you have a strong, viable, vital healthcare system that's accessible, that can be the hub. And so there's a possibility at the federal level to direct economic development funds into healthcare, to keep those doors open, to make sure they're providers, to make sure you group services around a healthcare system, the way in urban areas, sometimes it's grouped in a school, that the hospital does a whole lot more than treat patients. Often it is the nursing home capacity. Right. So you have a whole variety of services, the largest employer, access issues, all stemming from that hub and looking at it as the vital hub of a community, I think not only provides ongoing healthcare to patients, but can be a vitality issue for the community.
I guess there's no way to control about this, and this may be too nerdy or in the weeds, But you were saying about let's get the money into the rural communities. Let's make sure it's about healthcare and economic development. Are we worried that it might get in the wrong hands? Which is to say, you started off talking about how disabling the cuts have been to rural institutions. And I would just wonder, not that there's a lack of sophistication, but if you're trying to keep the doors open, you may not be thinking about the new idea. Right. And I won't say a city
Absolutely
slicker, but
right.
somebody might come in and say, hey, we can do this, and they're not wrong, but it's also not getting to the institutions that vitally need this support. What do you think about that scenario, and what might we do? And I know it's a 50-state solution here. What might be an answer?
Well, there are a lot of people smarter than I am who have spent a lot of time looking at the details. Let's start with the fact that the transformation grant was put together, I would say scrambled together in a big hurry as an attempt to try and have some funding to stop the bleeding that was going to occur with this massive cut to Medicaid. You know, cutting people off of services, cutting healthcare, you know, in a small rural community, the provider's payment is often directly tied to Medicaid, seniors' payment. You have a larger disabled community in rural areas. Their services, their home health services, tied to Medicaid. Medicaid pays for half the births in the country. So those cuts have real impact on the populations who live in rural areas, who often have a lower income level and are not in a workforce position that comes with health insurance. So it has these multiple effects. So, you know, you put together a pot of money, and unfortunately, the way Congress often does things, particularly when they're doing it in a hurry, is say everybody gets some. You know, we don't want to make anybody mad. So we're not going to try and identify problems and issues or states or anything else. We're just going to say all 50 states get some of this, and it's got to go to new and exciting things. And as we've talked a bit about, that's wrong on so many fronts. So I hope that there's a regrouping. Lots of states said, wait a minute, this makes no sense to us. You have no state involvement in a resource identification, where the gaps are. You have no input from our healthcare community. You have no input from our rural community. So I think there are ways to write the rules and regs to direct money to the appropriate sources, to have it flow through some state apparatus that has criteria around it. And that helps to eliminate, if you will, the bad actors. It helps to make sure that there's some verification of who actually is eligible to get this money, some kind of, you know, good housekeeping seal of approval that this is the real deal. We saw COVID money attempting to keep small businesses in place be pushed out the door very quickly. And unfortunately, some of it was pushed into the wrong hands. You know, if you could come up with a criteria, I mean, there are a lot of smart people out there who can write a grant in a heartbeat and identify themselves in any way, shape, or form. So the more you have local verification, local input, identification of who these folks are and what's going on, I think those are the guardrails, both that get the money into the right hands and make sure that the identification of where the health gaps are in communities matches where the money goes.
Well, call me a hopeless optimistic, but I have to say, reading what's coming out from the states to their looking for their RFPs, mm-hmm. sounds to me like you have at least good intent in the states as they go out there and try and identify specifically. They're very unique in terms of the things the states
right.
seem to be prioritizing. So I'm going to chalk that one up in my optimistic column.
I think that's right. You know, one of the things that we call for in the report is letting the local communities lead.
Right. Right.
You know, don't have a one size fits all. 50 million people are involved. But rural areas look very, very different state to state. They have different gaps. They have different challenges. So if the plan for improvement of health in rural areas comes out of the rural area and then bubbles up through a state system and into the federal government, that's much more likely to match the needs than some national design that is a little bit of everything for everybody.
Right. But the flip side of that is it's my understanding that you had some recommendations for an updated payment system for rural areas, exactly because of what you just said. Something like Medicaid gets cut back and the ripple effects are enormous. What were the principles of the updated payment system for rural areas that you would like to have seen?
Well, a lot of the principles really involve the Medicare system, and which is the primary payer to hospitals. Most hospitals rely on Medicare as a payment system. And what has been done traditionally, again, after the fact, in the rearview mirror, is the notion that the payment systems were designed for large hospitals. And then they said, well, we need rural access center. Well, we need emergency rural access centers. And again, it's sort of after the fact. So what we're really calling for is a sort of new design based on areas in the country that could be specifically called out. And there are several ways to do this. There's already a survey that is underway nationally, updated nationally, that is underserved areas. Some are rural, some urban. So you could use that rural definition. You could use a population center definition. You could use identify the communities where hospitals have closed. 300 hospitals have closed in rural areas in the last number of years. I mean, there are various ways to identify where it is. And it's really then a payment system designed to keep the essential services in that hospital running and flowing, recognizing that, you know, the smaller the scale, the higher the costs are likely to be on a per capita basis, but you still need essential services or you don't have a hospital. So you need to be able to treat people as they come in. You need transportation to get them to a trauma center. You need certain kinds of providers. You need access to a rural regional center where you may deliver babies and have, you know, high level trauma. It doesn't need to occur in every rural community, but that needs to be a spoken hub model that actually is supported financially. So hospitals don't have to scramble and put it together themselves.
Right. Well, we've certainly been struck by if 300 hospitals have closed, three times that many maternity, labor and delivery units have closed, which is a real crisis.
Yeah. You know, Margaret, one of our favorite groups of people and places to be is at Aspen Ideas Health. And we saw the secretary there in 2023 on a panel with Alex Azar, and who served in the first Trump administration as HHS secretary. You clearly have a sincere desire to reach across the aisle. I'm wondering, have you been in touch with Secretary Kennedy? And would you have any advice to share with him as he navigates these many intense situations, and particularly around rural health?
The answer is no. I had several visits with Bobby Kennedy before when I was secretary, and he was an advocate, and he came to my office a number of times. I know his family. I mean, his sister and I are friends. Three of his nieces worked for us in HHS, but he has not reached out. I'd be glad to talk to him about any number of things. I have been alarmed by the massive cuts that have occurred across HHS that have a pretty devastating effect on a lot of programs, a lot of infrastructure, and particularly at the CDC, which has really been devastated. I gather that, you know, they've made a new nomination finally for a CDC head. But I think the vaccine policies, and as you said, Margaret, earlier, what we find in rural areas is a real disconnect between what's available with preventive care and what people are accessing. And some of that is misinformation and disinformation. And it's unfortunately been driven from the bully pulpit of the White House, casting some doubt on scientific information and who the experts are. And we have a health secretary now who is a vaccine skeptic. I never thought we'd live in an era where we had the health secretary with a career having sued vaccine companies and suggesting things that are not at all scientifically proven. And that's really what his early visits to me were about, that he insisted that the various studies that he was familiar with should be promoted by the department. And, you know, I read them, I had experts read them, I looked at them, and I was very candid with him saying, you know, they're not fact-based. They're not based on anything that scientists have discovered or can link together. And, you know, it's actually harming people. So I'm afraid that we're in an era now. There are certainly some policies that deal with healthier eating and taking on some of the corporate food companies, which I applaud and think may be a good plan, but it's hard to mix and match information when you're told, you know, measles vaccines may not matter, we have a cure for measles, none of which is true, and, you know, taking red dye out of maraschino cherries, it's kind of not the same health impact.
I know we have many more questions and not too many minutes left, but I wanted to give you an opportunity. I know behavioral health has been a big concern of yours in terms of the health of our population across the United States. But was there a particular strategy that your group wanted to advance in terms of addressing the behavioral health needs of rural America?
Well, whatever challenges we have with behavioral health in this country are just, again, amplified. Any health issue that is a health issue any place, I think, is tougher in a rural community. So the stigma issue is higher. Access to providers, particularly providers dealing with children. A lot of telehealth has been helpful in terms and helpful reducing stigma and connecting people with experts. Unfortunately, there's still lots of rural communities in America without, you know, high-speed broadband. So you have this series of challenges, transportation issues. Again, having a community that has access to experts, whether that's through telehealth or in person, paying for that realistically. Rural areas may need different rules about specialty access than urban areas do, because it's just different. If you can only contact a specialists by computer and they need broadband access. So it's a multiple challenge, but we certainly identified and called out the need for infrastructure, roads, transportation, and broadband in many of these communities is healthcare access. It's not the same in a lot of urban areas, but that's the only way to get to a doctor, to see a doctor, to get advice from a doctor, and those are essential.
Secretary Sebelius outlined both the urgency and the opportunity to rethink rural health care from payment systems and workforce to infrastructure and community-driven solutions. In this Conversations on Healthcare with co-host Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner. Still to come on this Tuesday's Main Street, Dr. Tom Eason shares The Hungry Bachelor, a frontier ballad shaped by life on the prairie. And in Our Living Lands, the Chickasaw Nation plants trees to preserve both climate and culture for the next generation. That's ahead on Main Street right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this Plains Folk essay, Dr. Tom Eason takes us to the Montana Highline, where bachelor homesteaders turn hardship into harmony, reimagining a prairie classic in a one-room schoolhouse.
Christmas Eve, 2015, on the Montana Highline, somewhere near Glasgow, in a one-room school called Willow Bend. Miss Miller had prepared her pupils well, and the local correspondent declared their program a success. Then there was the ringer, a quartet of bachelor homesteaders, the Willow Creek Quartet, comprising Will Lloyd, bass, Raymond Sullivan, baritone, James Lloyd, tenor, and L.O. Carter, Lorenzo Otis Carter, that is. The absence of a park designation with his listing indicates he was the lead singer. And what did the Willow Creek Quartet sing? Country correspondents in those days gave full coverage to local school events, and so the Glasgow Courier printed full text, but no title. Oh, the hinges are of leather, and the windows have no glass. The dirt roof lets the howling blizzard in. We can see the hungry bachelor a-coming down the trail for his supper in our cabin on the plain. I know this song. It's the anthem of the plains, Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim, a song that originated in 1881 in Smith County, Kansas. The original text was by a printer, Frank E. Jerome. It circulated to find new life in many settler localities, especially in the Jim River Valley of Dakota Territory. The song returned to Kansas, from which it erupted to anywhere on the plains the settler sod house experience transpired, including Montana, 1915. And the song underwent localization and imaginative adaptation. In this case, the traditional hungry coyote lurking around the shack becomes a hungry bachelor. But the ballad tradition on the plains goes beyond just tinkering with folk poetry. It also includes bachelor homesteaders able to generate and sing four-part harmony on a song for which no sheet music existed. This is exponential folk life. The linchpin of the ensemble was Carter, a widower with two boys, holding down a claim, which he would prove up in 1916, and earning a press reputation as one of the most prominent farmers in the Willow Creek District. He was in the papers a lot, clearing rock from his claim, hiring a steam rig for breaking, stacking hay, hauling wood, taking off heavy crops of wheat and flax, and making himself beloved by good works. For instance, in May 1915, the local physician, Dr. Pease, was in a dither how to replace his barn, which had burned, when there appeared in his farmyard a convoy of eight men and teams assembled from all directions, their wagon frames burdened with enough logs for a new barn. There was Carter among them. He was, in popular estimation, something of a ladies' man, too. He was mentioned in association with a previous schoolteacher, and at the time of the quartet's debut, he was known to be chauffeuring Miss Miller to the schoolhouse along with his boys. Just before Christmas 1915, the Lloyd boys had got up a rabbit hunt involving Carter and about 40 men, with an oyster feed following. They took home rabbits for home consumption, leading to the opening lines of the quartet's ballad. We're happy as a clam on our claim from Uncle Sam, though the rabbit is not always fried the best. Well, I reckon not, because you can't fry white-tailed jackrabbit. You better stew it. Thus, the men recognized the deficiency of women's skills in their homestead lives.
NDSU's Dr. Tom Ezern reminds us that on the plains, even the loneliest lives could find connection in song, in story, and in the shared experience of making a home on the land.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In southern Oklahoma, the Chickasaw Nation is planting trees to combat climate change. The project's also ensuring that Chickasaw culture gets passed down to the next generation. KOSU's Sarah Lisi has more.
You guys like playing in dirt?
Yeah.
What we need.
On a crisp fall morning, Chickasaw Nation Head Start students gather in a field at the Okyanali Preserve, located on the tribe's reservation between Oklahoma City and Dallas.
Hey guys, let's go. Let's go plant the tree. Come on.
About 20 children are grabbing soil and packing it together to create a healthy foundation for 25 young trees. It's an effort funded by a U.S. Forest Service grant under the Inflation Reduction Act.
Here, Mavis, just put the dirt in there.
Fighter. 4-year-old Mavis June Wilson and her mom Julie were among the group participating.
What did you feel when you were planting a tree? Did you feel happy, excited?
I feel happy and excited.
Julie says she's Seminole, and Mavis is both Seminole and Chickasaw. Seeing Mavis cultivate a relationship with the land this young, Julie says, is important to her.
We used to live off the land, whether it was going and gathering or hunting or whatever, you know, the land always provides.
Yeah, that's a big root.
But the lands they are standing on now were not open fields before. There used to be more trees that prevented erosion along the Blue River and surface water runoff during storms. Katie Gillis works as the Director of Conservation at the Nature Conservancy, a global nonprofit that partnered with the Chickasaw Nation in 2012 to protect the lands at the Okeonolly Preserve. Gillis says this area was hardwood bottomland before colonization.
And after these lands left Chickasaw ownership, the ranchers cleared it entirely and turned it into meadow. And so we are actively working to restore it.
Restoring the land to its natural state will ultimately help combat climate change. More native trees can help filter pollution and cool the community when it's hot outside. But experts say that works best when the right species and number of trees are planted.
A few years ago, we planted over 4,000 trees and put sinuosity back in the creeks that feed the Blue River here to keep water on this land longer and to raise the water table. So the 25 trees that the Chickasaws want to plant here fits in perfectly with our restoration efforts.
But this work, if done correctly, isn't just good for the local environment. It's also personal to the Chickasaw people, says Jeannie Mosley, the Chickasaw Nation's Sustainability Director.
And the trees that we're planting today are all culturally significant trees. So we have bur oak, we have pecan, and these are all trees that Chickasaw people used to survive when they first came over here from our homelands.
Mosley descends from three tribes in Oklahoma, the Chickasaw, Kiowa, and Comanche. Like Julie Wilson, she remembers the imprint the land left on her people through her father's teachings.
He said that whenever you think about land, you have to realize that people died for it. So the people that have survived, it just kind of shows me that I am honored to take care of this land because I'm kind of keeping their memory alive.
The memory also lives on now with this new generation of young people like Mavis.
She's graduating this year, and this is something that she gets to do, and another 10, 15 years, she gets to come back and actually look at the tree that she planted when she was almost 5 years old.
The tree Mavis helped plant is an oak tree. In front of it is a little nameplate showing both its English and Chickasaw names.
The tree symbolizes her, and she's going to go through changes in life, and so is that tree. And I hope that she remembers that no matter what happens in life, changes are always going to happen, whether it's going to be good or whether it's going to be bad. And it's just part of life.
The trees and the land here at the preserve are a reminder of Chickasaw history. And that no matter the adversity, these children and the land are finding ways to prevail. For KOSU, I'm Sarah Lisi.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Plains Art Museum in Fargo hosts its Spring Gala 2026 Nightmare at the Museum, Saturday, May 2nd from 7 p.m. to midnight. The event includes food, wine tasting, an art auction, and music by DJ Ower. More information at plainsart.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
The war with Iran is endangering marine life. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The war in the Middle East, started by the U.S. and Israel, could have catastrophic consequences for the environment, including in the waters of the Persian Gulf.
Images taken by the European Space Agency show spills from vessels and coastal facilities that have been targeted by the U.S., Israel, or Iran.
The Persian Gulf is rich in marine biodiversity, including coral reefs, sea turtles, mangroves, and more than 700 species of fish, as well as dugongs, a marine mammal related to manatees. Even before the war, its ecology was threatened by climate change, overexploitation, and pollution.
The Gulf has many islands, and satellite photos taken earlier this month showed an oil spill spanning more than 5 miles in the Strait of Hormuz near one of them, called Keshem.
An airstrike on another, Lavan, has led to a major environmental emergency, according to the Dutch organization PAX. That spill was heading to Shidvar Island, which is a protected wildlife refuge and is known as Iran's Maldives.
The oil pollution also threatens the livelihoods of thousands of people who rely on marine resources for income and food, and filtration systems that desalinate water for millions.
It is not likely that the cleanup of oil spills will occur soon, leading to worsening conditions for ecosystems.
Over a month ago, Greenpeace Germany reported that there were as many as 85 oil tankers trapped in the Gulf, which it described as an environmental disaster waiting to happen.
The tap water of almost 20% of people in the U.S. may contain elevated levels of nitrates, which have been linked to birth defects and cancer risks.
A study from the nonprofit Environmental Working Group showed that between 2021 and 2023, 62 million Americans were exposed to the pollutant, likely from fertilizers and agricultural runoff, manure from feeding operations, and wastewater discharge.
Nitrates are invisible and odorless and have also been associated with thyroid disease and preterm births.
The report showed that almost two-thirds of water systems with nitrate levels at or above the legal standard were in California, Texas, Kansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma, which have large agricultural industries.
The report also says that drinking water across the U.S. contains hundreds of chemicals, heavy metals, and radioactive substances, often at levels higher than what scientists consider safe, even if it's in compliance with federal standards.
The group says that people can protect their drinking water and reduce risks by using a carbon filter or a reverse osmosis system.
The sound of rain on a windowsill can be soothing for humans, but if you're a dormant seed underground, it can be a vexing wake-up call.
That's according to new research from MIT, which found that vibrations caused by raindrops can awaken seeds and signal that it's time to get growing.
We know that plants respond to stimuli. Some recoil when touched, while others fold inward when exposed to heat or toxins. And of course, most plants respond to light, reaching toward the sun to help them grow.
But they also understand gravity, knowing to send roots down and shoots up. They do this through statoliths, envelopes of starch at the bottom of their cells. When statoliths are jostled, sprouting kicks into gear.
To test whether rain could be enough to affect the statolith, the team experimented with rice seeds, which grow in shallow, watery fields.
They exposed the seeds to water droplet sounds that would occur in light, moderate, or heavy storms. They found that the seeds germinated 30 to 40% faster than ones in quiet conditions.
They also found that seeds that were closer to the surface could better sense the rain and grow faster compared to those more submerged.
Hearing rain can be a biological advantage for seeds, the team says. Establishing a Goldilocks zone that's close enough to the surface to feel raindrops, but deep enough to soak up the moisture. And finally, hot as Hades. Hot enough to fry an egg on the sidewalk, a real scorcher. Those are phrases we commonly use to describe intense heat.
But in Japan, which experienced its hottest summer on record last year, its meteorological agency has an official lexicon for forecasts.
Currently, they have terms for typical summer and midsummer heat. In 2007, the word Moshobi was introduced to describe an extremely hot day over 95 degrees Fahrenheit.
But it's become clear that a new term is needed. On April 17th, the agency introduced Kokushobi for days surpassing 40 degrees Celsius or around 104 degrees Fahrenheit. The word koku means cruel or harsh.
Kokushobi might come in handy this summer. The World Meteorological Organization just announced that El Niño conditions could return as early as May, causing above-normal temperatures nearly everywhere on the planet, and models suggest it might be a whopper.
El Niño refers to above-average sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific Ocean, and the phenomenon often brings a range of impacts from drought, wildfires, and floods.
Extreme weather events and heat waves are becoming more common and intense with climate change as we burn fossil fuels, creating conditions for which there may one day be no words to describe.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 28th. His Royal Highness, the American baby, will have the entire nation bowing before him. Originating in Chicago in 1914, the movement known as Baby Week sought to raise awareness of the high infant mortality rate in the U.S. and to educate young mothers and girls about early child care. Researchers from the Children's Bureau estimated the infant mortality rate in the U.S. at nearly 1 in 10 in the 1910s. National attention fastened on the issue, and Baby Week was born. The movement proved quite popular among young women, especially first-time mothers. But despite the large amount of press it received, infant mortality and ignorance about early child care remained major problems. So the movement continued, and Baby Week became an annual celebration across the country. In 1916, Baby Week reached North Dakota. At that time, the Sioux County Pioneer estimated the number of preventable infant deaths to be as high as 150,000. On this date in 1917, North Dakota kicked off its second major celebration of the baby. Different locations put their own twist on the event with slogans like Grand Babies for Grand Forks, Bismarck's Better Babies, and Baby Week on the Reservation at Fort Yates. The tide of sympathy for the baby was on full display in public lectures, charitable donations, and volunteer efforts. Lectures covered topics such as disease and early child care, with special attention to malnutrition and infection, then considered the leading causes of infant mortality. Many businesses hosted large Baby Week sales, advertising everything from bassinets to bottles, from chairs to clothing, and adding a patriotic touch. The Boy Scouts in some cities distributed flags to families with a child under 1 year old. Though many of the dangers of early child care have receded in the modern age, some still participate in Baby Week celebrations, now focused more on celebrating the lives of babies and mothers than on instruction. The baby craze has not disappeared, and thanks to advances in modern medicine, the once high infant mortality rate has largely become a thing of the past. But no matter the era, we can still take to heart the words of a poem from the Children's Bureau. I am yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I am your hope. I am the baby. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Leonidas Miller. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments in a case over a plan that could lead to the mass deportation of people who have been living legally in the U.S. The Trump administration wants to end the Temporary Protective Status Program, which lets eligible refugees come to the U.S. if they can't return to their own countries. We break down the details on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Curious minds make happy campers at North Dakota's Gateway to Science in Bismarck. Summer camp registration is now open, with week-long adventures running May 26th through August 14th. Campers explore science, technology, engineering, and math through hands-on experiments, creative problem-solving, and activities, all in a fun, supportive environment where friendships and confidence grow, offering morning or afternoon half-day camps or full-day options to fit your summer schedule. More information and registration can be found online at gatewaytoscience.org.
And that's it for this Tuesday's Main Street. Thanks for spending time with us today. Tomorrow on the show, from classroom to retreat, the Nome Schoolhouse Inn and Event Center brings a new life to a 1916 rural schoolhouse, now a destination for lodging, dining, and hands-on learning. It's a place where history, creativity, and community come together on the prairie. Plus, patio season is here, and few do it better than Junkyard Brewing Company. Junkyard Brewing joins Prairie Plates to talk about pints, pizza, and the draw of gathering outdoors as summer approaches. It's history reimagined and a taste of summer tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.